Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones on the ground in Pakistan. Has the tide turned in the fight against the Taliban? But first to Washington, where there is some bipartisanship breaking out, but maybe not the kind President Obama would like. Democrats joined Republicans today in overwhelmingly passing an amendment to the war funding bill, which denies the president any money for the release or transfer of Guantanamo detainees into the U.S. Republicans have made this a central issue, accusing the Obama administration of planning to move terrorists to the streets of the U.S. if Guantanamo is closed, and the dispute's been holding up passage of the much larger, nearly $100 billion war funding bill. Well, Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, has been following all of this. Gail, what was the vote today to withhold funding to move detainees? Any nays?
90-6. Very lopsided vote, only 6 Democrats supporting the White House.
Well, put this in context. How big a tempest had this become?
Much bigger than Democrats expected. Back at the beginning of May, Republicans introduced a bill called Keep the Terrorists Out of America Act that included language like, do you want deadly terrorists in your neighborhood? And they kept repeating it. I think the Republican leader spoke at least 18 times on the floor about this. And eventually, this week, it really caught up in the polls, public reacting very strongly in what one analyst referred to as NIMBY on steroids. That is, not in my backyard, on steroids.
Well, but the president had some allies. Senator Dick Durbin pointed out not a single prisoner has ever escaped from a federal supermax prison, and that 347 convicted terrorists are already being held in U.S. prisons. But he also said yesterday that Democrats were feeling like they were defending the unknown if they funded the president's request to close Gitmo, because they're not hearing a plan. Is that the sticking point?
That's exactly the point. You know, even Democrats that spoke from the floor, Dianne Feinstein, who's the head of the Intelligence Committee, said, look, we know that Gitmo, Guantanamo, makes the United States less safe in the world. It is such a lightning rod, such a symbol for abuse. We really need to get rid of it. But even she voted against this proposal to provide funding to get rid of it, because she said we need a detailed plan. The chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Senator Inouye, referred to this as a wake-up call, and I think that's really the way to understand it. The president has plenty of support in his party for this move, but not until the groundwork has been carefully laid out with the public.
Well, and you mentioned the not-in-my-backyard aspect. Both of Montana's Democratic senators joined the state's Republican representative in opposing a suggestion to put Gitmo detainees in their state. There's a state-of-the-art jail in Hardin, Montana, we understand, and people there felt, you know, it would even help the economy.
Exactly. Well, you also have late-night television getting into the act on this as well. Jon Stewart had a spoof about this last night that I think is laying a different kind of argument. He showed images of, you know, really dangerous people and, you know, rolling his eyes at the suggestion that if we can take care of someone like this, clearly we can deal with detainees as well. So this is not over. This is it's an ongoing discussion with the American people, but it really needs the eloquence of President Obama and the plan that his advisors are putting together.
Well, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, one of the few Republicans to call for Guantanamo to be closed, also scoffed at this notion that there's no way to hold prisoners in the U.S. He said, you know, we held almost 500,000 German and Japanese prisoners during World War II.
Exactly.
But if there are no funds to move detainees, does this mean that Guantanamo Bay, you know, can't, until that plan comes up, close? Because we know that the president has had a hard time getting other countries to take detainees.
Exactly. Well, the Pentagon has a great deal of money that is fungible. So what this technically does is say you can't use money available until October 1st on this plan, but there's also appropriation bills for defense moving through the system that could fund this, and I think the Pentagon could also gear up for it in advance. So they say it's not a problem. The real issue now is more political, I think.
Yeah, and a big victory for, at least for today, for Republicans who long been attacking the proposal to close Guantanamo Bay. Gail Chad, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor from the halls of Congress, following today's vote for us again, the Senate voting to block any funds to move detainees from Guantanamo Bay into the U.S. Gail, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, there are new reports today of concern that arms sent by the U.S. to Afghanistan to fight the Taliban there have instead armed the Taliban there. And in Pakistan, the Taliban has been holding off a Pakistan Army assault launched last month in the Swat Valley that's created what the U.N. calls one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. Hundreds of thousands of Pakistanis crammed into dusty refugee camps, more than a million people fleeing the fighting. So, can Pakistan defeat the Taliban? Let's get an overview from someone right there on the ground. He's the BBC's Owen Bennett Jones. He joins us from Islamabad. And Owen, we've asked you this question so many times before, but I'm wondering if you have a different answer today. Do you think Pakistan can defeat the Taliban? Is there something different about this offensive?
Well, there is something different about it, yes, but whether they can win, I think, is an open question. The difference is that the public opinion in Pakistan has changed. There is now a clear support for what the army's doing, and it's new. And you read the op-ed pages of the papers here, and everyone is saying the Taliban are barbarians. They murder, they slaughter, they behead. It's unacceptable. We must fight. It's as if people have been given permission to say what they always thought. The ambiguity that existed in Pakistan about these groups has gone. So that is a very significant change, and we'll just have to see how long it lasts. My hunch is that the army will find it very difficult, that there will be tough fighting for months, and that the public opinion may well swing back, saying, look, we can't do this. This is just too much suffering. There are too many people who are unable to go back to their homes. It's going on too long. Let's do a deal. But we'll have to see. It's an open question just now.
Well, meanwhile, I know you visited these refugee camps. We want to hear what it's like in the camps, but you heard some of that new sentiment. Let's listen to a clip.
They were beheading people. They were shooting innocent people without any warning. They were terrifying us. They are not friends. They are not our allies. They are our enemies. They are criminals. They are gangsters.
Now, it's interesting hearing that, isn't it? Because you wouldn't really have heard people speaking about the Taliban quite so clearly before. And I have seen DVDs, which are just totally disgusting. I mean, I've seen a DVD of a soldier standing, head hooded, decapitated with a single swipe of a huge sword. I mean, it's the most revolting thing I've ever seen in my life. It keeps popping into my head unbidden. Now, this is what these people in SWAT have been living with for some months. I mean, there's one man, he said he buried 18 beheaded people, including some children. Unbelievable what's been going on.
And these are Taliban propaganda videos. In other words, they're hoping that it frightens or sways people to their side, but it's having the opposite effect, you're saying.
Right. Yeah. And now people are speaking out. So it is an important change. But as I say, we'll just have to see how significant it turns out to be.
Well, what was the change? Was it just that revulsion? Or did anything else happen that changed public opinion?
Yeah, three things happened. There was a video of a woman being flogged. You may have seen it. You can see it on YouTube. And it was in the Swat Valley. And it really shocked Pakistanis because they suddenly thought, you know, the Taliban, I mean, it's like the word means religious student. It's like monk. You know, it's monk in the Middle Ages, if you like. It's a very positive connotation. And so people tended to think well of people who study religion. I mean, it's a very religious country here.
Well, in fact, Owen, I have to interrupt for just a moment to say that behind you we're hearing a call to prayer. Very common. So if people thought this was just a religious organization, that would not be a problem.
Right. And they tend to respect people who spend their lives, as you know, in many faiths, go to a monastery or something and temple or whatever it is and devote their lives to religion. So they were very shocked when they saw these Taliban, flogging a young, frail girl. And they thought, we don't. Yeah, that's terrible. And then the Taliban moved. They did this peace deal in Swat, and then they took more territory, quite close to Islamabad. And people started thinking, this could happen here. So there was real change. And I think the third thing that changed was the American politicians and diplomats really came here and persuaded Nawaz Sharif, this former prime minister, a man with huge credibility in the country, by far the most popular politician in the country at the moment, and they persuaded him basically not to oppose a campaign against the Taliban. And those three things have explained the switch.
Well, so that explains the change in attitude. You were also in Peshawar, the capital of the Northwest province, where the Taliban are targeting police there. Tell us about that, because we know you have some sound from there as well.
Yeah, hundreds of police have been killed, and they have been victims of suicide attacks, of shootings, of ambushes, and so on. I mean, basically, they don't do anything anymore. They're restricted to, you know, guarding the VIPs, to guarding a few buildings, and they, in large parts of northwest Pakistan, they've lost control. One of the first things the Taliban do when they go into an area is kills, normally by beheading. Some police terrify the other police. Everyone leaves. Police leave for fear of their lives, and then, you know, the Taliban take over. I was speaking to Malik Navid Khan. Now, he is the most senior policeman, in fact, in Northwest Frontier Province. He's the Inspector General of Police, NWFP. And he told me a bit about how the Taliban are targeting the police.
They are being kidnapped. Their families are being kidnapped. One of our superintendents of police, his brother has been kidnapped, and he has been told to resign from the force.
Your brother was killed in a suicide attack.
My brother was killed in a suicide attack just right here in Peshawar, in the city. We are facing this war, but for every victory, there have to be sacrifices.
Interesting that they're now talking about the sacrifices.
That's right. It's a sign that the mood has changed, and people saying that they need to make sacrifices for the nation. I should tell you one story about it. Not the police chief, but a political agent. They're the guys who, they're civil servants, and they run the tribal areas, and they sort of have fantastic powers. Collective punishment. They can lock people up for 2 years without a trial and so on. And this guy was saying, the Taliban, they want medieval. I'll give them medieval. He's just building a dungeon in his tribal headquarters. He says, if I capture any of these people, that's where they're going.
Well, you know, that might lead to a lot of other questions. But meanwhile, the Pakistani military says it's killed more than 1,000 insurgents in the fighting so far. But is there any way of knowing, when we started by saying, can the army win, even with this changed attitude, is there any way of knowing whether the offensive is working?
Well, I mean, I think we do know a bit. I mean, there are very few journalists there, and those that are there are only with the army. So, no, we don't really know. But what we do know is this, that it's been going on for 3 weeks, and they haven't taken the main town in Swat. I don't think they're even close to taking the main town in Swat. We know that the Taliban aren't running away, that they're digging in, that they're defending positions that they've established, because the army's left this very late. And it's, you know, been going on for years, really. So the Taliban have good defensible positions, and they're not afraid to stand and fight, which I presume means that they think they can win. So we'll have to see as the news. I mean, journalists here are pretty gutsy, and there will be, I'm sure, young men and maybe young women going up into these very violent areas with cameras trying to get pictures of what's going on. And there are a lot of very lively independent TV channels here which will be broadcasting those pictures. I think over the next 2 or 3 weeks we'll have a clearer idea of how the fighting's actually going.
The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones in Pakistan. We'll have much more after a break, and later, honoring a mental health worker killed in Iraq. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones in Islamabad, Pakistan. We're talking about the military's now three-week-old assault on the Taliban-controlled Swat Valley in northwest Pakistan. And Owen, before the break, you were talking about how that offensive might be going. And I'm thinking of a man that you spoke with. His name is Khalid Aziz. He's the former chief secretary of the Northwest Frontier Province. He says the fight against the Taliban should start at the top. Let's listen.
If you look at it, how many people would be involved in the top leadership? 15, 20. And the six biggest military, if it cannot take care of 15, 16 individuals, I'm sorry, we are not good at it.
Yeah, interesting to hear him say that. I'm not convinced by that, to be honest. You know, the Americans with their huge military machine have been unable to get Osama bin Laden or al-Zawahiri. And I'm not sure how significant it is. It's beyond that now. I mean, everyone's here. I think these guys are hoping that they can just get rid of Fazlullah, Sufi Muhammad, Bayatullah Massoud, these Premier League of the Taliban leadership. You know, had they done this 4 or 5 years ago, and people were telling them to do so, You know, they could have neutralized some of these guys quite easily. But they're up against a movement.
Well, Owen Bennett-Jones, what else has to happen then? Because if there are increasing numbers of members of the Taliban, and if the leadership might be hard to target, hand in hand with the fighting, what else has to happen?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that has to happen. The United States has been asking Pakistan to do this for about 4 years. And maybe it's been very, very late. It has been very, very late. But they've done it. As a result, 2 million people have had to leave their homes. Now, you know, we say these things. It's so easy to say that on the radio. But it is an awful lot of people who are in great, great distress. I mean, just imagine it. And a lot of these people have many children and they are extremely poor. And so they have walked for miles and miles and miles, gathering whatever they can on their backs, and they are living in most unsatisfactory conditions, which I imagine they will have to endure for months or years. And it is surely incumbent on the countries that required Pakistan to do this to come up with some money to help these people live moderately decent lives. And, you know, we've just heard from the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, 100 million. Well, frankly, it could be 100 million a month, and I'm not convinced it would be enough. And that is what is going to turn this battle, because if these refugees, or IDPs, I should say, internally displaced people, are going to say, well, we're not happy, let's go with the Taliban, then the West has lost.
So you're pretty much saying that the West owns Pakistan right now?
Well, I mean, there are many people saying that the only reason the Pakistan army acted was because General Petraeus said, you've got 2 weeks or, I don't know what the or was, and that report hasn't been confirmed and the US hasn't confirmed it, but I mean, that's what a lot of politicians here believe. And when you think that the United States has given $12 billion to Pakistan since 9/11, almost entirely for the military, and you then have 2 million people on the move, then surely it is appropriate to give more than $100 million to those people.
By the way, you mentioned the dollars, Owen Bennett-Jones. Do you fear that in Pakistan, much of that money to fight the Taliban went to arm the Taliban, as reports are saying happened in Afghanistan?
Not to arm the Taliban. I think a lot of it went into the army main sort of budgets to worry about India, to be honest. It's only now just switching to the internal enemy, if you like. They've always thought in terms of India. So that's where I suspect a lot of this $12 billion went. Don't forget, a lot of it went to American contractors. They skim off probably 30%. So how much of it went to these Pakistani soldiers, brave men, I've met some of them, out in the valleys and cold high mountains in the snow fighting the Taliban now? Well, I'm not convinced they've got an awful lot of it.
And you mentioned the army. The history of Pakistan has been the army also turning on the government. For now, it feels as if the army is willing to go do this fighting that, well, you spoke to a soldier injured in the fighting. He was hit by an anti-aircraft gun. I think both his legs were broken, and he talked about how strong the Taliban are. But there have been questions about whether or not the Pakistan military really wants to be in this fight. And here's what he told you about fighting the Taliban, fellow Pakistanis.
You can't say fellow Pakistani to them. They are killing the innocent people. Hopefully, in a couple of weeks, I will be back on my feet. And inshallah, I will be there again to perform my duties.
You want to fight again?
Oh, definitely, why not? To save my nation.
So Owen Bennett-Jones, is that a change, and is it a tenuous loyalty?
I think these soldiers know why they're fighting, and they think they're doing the right thing. And I think that was much less clear 6 months ago. The reason I went to that hospital, actually, is I saw a TV interviewer had been into it and talked to some soldiers about 3 months ago, had come back saying, I've just lost my legs, and I'm not terribly sure why. You know, I think the people we're fighting are probably a bit more Islamic than I am, and I rather respect them. So there was uncertainty. And I think that has gone. And from what I can understand, these young men who are going to take this fight to the Taliban, who are taking this fight to the Taliban, do believe they're doing it in the national Pakistani interest. There is great resentment of the fact that they've been pushed into do it by America, and I can see why Americans would find that extremely confusing, because surely this is in Pakistan's interest. But with these various conflicting ideas going on, there is no doubt that these soldiers think they're doing the right thing now.
The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones. Owen, we so appreciate hearing from you. I'm wondering, before we let you go, here you are in the refugee camps out on the, as you said, the snowy tundras. It's just one image that comes to mind that you could share with us. You've shared some horrific images from Taliban videos, but just something you want to leave us with.
I will do that, and it is this. If you go to the city of Lahore, you see the other side of Pakistan. I had a meal last night amongst delightful Pakistani company on the roof of a very ancient building overlooking a monumental and very ancient mosque. There are many, many Pakistanis who want to live decent, normal lives just like anybody else. They are very worried by what's going on in their country. They are extremely upset that so many of their fellow countrymen have been forced to leave their homes. They're distressed. They're worried about it. They're very philanthropic as a rule. They're giving money and making collections for these internally displaced people. And the images we get on the TV, it is part of Pakistan, I'm afraid. It is part of the reality here. But there is another reality, and this country has 170 million people in it, and the Taliban represent a very small percentage of them.
The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones speaking to us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Owen, thanks as always.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, on the trail of swine flu, we'll speak with a doctor who combines medical research with detective work to track the virus. Also, journalist John Pomfret on being in Tiananmen Square 20 years ago. Still to come today, Kenyan music hits U.S. dance clubs. That's after the latest news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a couple of minutes, has the military's attitudes towards mental health changed? But first,
live long and prosper.
And Mr. Spock could have added, build your own captain's chair, because that's what some fans of the Star Trek oeuvre are doing. Before the blockbuster new movie, which has already grossed over $200 million worldwide, there were fans of the 43-year-old television series, and the New York Times found some who've gone so far as to build their own Star Trek furniture. Todd Sturgeon of Auburn, Washington, has built a replica of the captain's chair used by Kirk in the original television series. He joins us now. Todd, why?
Well, you know, I was looking around for a fun project to do. I enjoy woodworking, and I also love Star Trek. And the idea of building Captain Kirk's chair just kind of popped into my head.
Now, did you go to look at the real seat? Because we understand it is in the Science Fiction Museum in Seattle.
That's correct, yes. And I have gone to look at it. It's in a glass case, so you can't get any measurements or anything. But I would go on occasion and try and take the surreptitious picture or two and get an idea for the feel.
When I ever see that thing, I think barber chair. You know, it comes up a little high. Describe it for people who aren't recalling it.
Well, it starts out with a platform that's about 4 or 5 inches high where your feet sit, and then the chair comes up on a column that's about 18 inches in diameter, and it swivels on that column.
Right. But yes. The original can be difficult to sit in. Do I understand that? Shatner fell over when he sat in it.
Yes. Apparently, the first time he sat in it, he leaned back, and it flipped him out the back. But it's a very wide chair. So as you're sitting in it, there's a full hand breadth to either side of your legs and the arms. So it causes you to kind of lean over to get to the armrest. And
yeah.
I think if you see him sitting in the chair, he often had one arm out on the side and was kind of in a lean. And
yeah.
He leaned a bit forward because he was afraid of falling backwards again.
Oh. And we thought it was his attentiveness to everything happening. But
yes, yes. Just, well, you know, it gave him that look. And when someone wants to have that kind of Kirk look and strike that pose, they always have to do that kind of lean forward and to the side.
Okay. Well, now, so how does it feel to sit in it, the replica you made?
It feels good. I actually added a little extra padding. The original was a little slim on that from what we had discovered. George Takei actually sat in it once, and he did say that it was definitely more comfortable than the original.
Oh, wait a minute. George Takei sat in your chair?
Yes, yes.
He played?
He was Sulu on the original series.
Wow.
I lent the chair to a 40th anniversary convention that had a number of actors there, and they used it for photo ops.
And I imagine now you have Star Trek fans from around the world knocking on your door to sit in the chair that he sat in.
You know, it's whenever I have some friends over who are Trek fans and even non-Trek fans, they all want to sit in the chair. They all want pictures.
That's so weird.
You know, it is. You know, people walk into the house and they see it, and sometimes it registers right away and sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, eventually they clue in, and because it is a rather large piece sitting in the living room. It
right.
takes about a 4x4 section there. And, you know, it's iconic. Once people realize that it's there, they say, wait a minute, that's Captain Kirk's chair.
Yeah. Well, but on the other hand, you know, even William Shatner famously on Saturday Night Live said to fans, get over it. You know,
yeah,
get a life.
Get a life.
Right.
Get a life.
Do you have anyone say that to you? I mean...
Oh, you know, they shake their head at me. But, I mean, it's not like I'm, you know, living in mom's basement and incessantly discussing the details of the episodes from 40 years ago. I mean, you know, I've got a wife, a job, an SUV, the whole nine yards.
Well, and now you've seen the new movie. You saw it opening night.
I did.
Is the chair in it?
There's a new chair to match the new bridge. It doesn't look at all like the original bridge. There's his chair is white now. It's much more streamlined, a little bit more curvy, but it still has kind of that look that, you know, this is where the person who's in charge sits.
And that would be Todd Sturgeon from Auburn, Washington. Todd, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Navy Commander Charles Keith Springle will be remembered today in a funeral service in North Carolina. The 52-year-old father of two was one of five troops shot and killed in a mental health clinic in Iraq by Army Sergeant John Russell, who'd been stripped of his gun and ordered into counseling, and then reportedly wrestled a weapon from the soldier escorting him to the clinic. Ironically, Keith Springle, one of two mental health workers killed, had volunteered to serve to help exactly the kind of man who allegedly shot and killed him. Suicide rates in the military are at an all-time high, with at least 109 suicides already this year. But the military faces a host of mental health-related issues. The Pentagon has begun addressing that with on-base mental health facilities like the one that Keith Springle was killed in. Bob Goodale was a friend and colleague of Commander Springle. He's director of behavioral mental health at the Citizen Soldier Support Program. That's a pilot training program funded by Congress with the hopes of going nationwide. It's in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where Commander Springle volunteered before going overseas. Bob Goodale, welcome. And, you know, we're just so sorry for your loss.
It is a really great loss.
Yeah. Well, help us understand why. You say Commander Springle volunteered. How does that work? Was he trained? You know, what did he do?
Well, Keith was very well trained, as a matter of fact. He's a psychologist, a licensed clinical social worker who'd served in the Navy for 22 years and was director of the Community Counseling Center at Camp Lejeune. His colleagues helped develop the program.
And then Commander Springle began volunteering with you, enacting the Citizen Soldier Support Program there in Chapel Hill.
It's very difficult work. Keith knew it was difficult. Also very, very important work. Training civilian providers so that when the service men and women come back, and particularly from the reserve component, that don't go to a military treatment facility, but go home, often to rural and frontier America, where the clinicians may not understand military culture, may not understand what it was like, what it is like over there, what happened, and what it's like now.
And we understand this is particularly important because some troops are returning to areas where mental health facilities are hours away. But then, continuing with our storyline, Commander Springle, who already has a son and a son-in-law serving in Iraq, volunteered to serve there as well?
He did, as a matter of fact, yes. Volunteered. He knew that's where he wanted to be, and that's where he could be most effective. And so he volunteered. Keith was a man who was always looking forward, looking to what he could do to help his fellow men.
Yeah, well, he said he wanted to be at the heart of battle. I bet he never guessed it would be in the heart of the mental health clinic. When you heard of his death, what was your thought?
Profound. I was moved by it profoundly. I learned about it about 5 a.m. when I opened my email a week ago Tuesday. And I was, you know, profoundly affected. And but the message is that we must persevere, just persevere, persevere.
Well, tell us more about this, because we know you did not know Sergeant John Russell, 44 years old, on his third tour, allegedly wrestled a gun from someone escorting him and went back to the clinic and shot five. From reports, we're learning that he had learning disabilities. He was known to be somewhat erratic, especially closer to that day. He was teased by other troops. And conflicting reports, friends said that He thought he had stress, but he kept getting sent back from the clinic. Other reports, his father saying that he feared going to the clinic. He thought it was a prelude to being drummed out of the military. So again, you didn't know John Russell, but John Russell was on his third tour, and we're hearing that these kinds of mental health issues increase the more tours someone's gone on.
There's no question about it. There's much evidence that the number of deployments adds to the stress. And, you know, it's not unusual to hear even of 5 tours. That's why they need to have the clinics in the field to stop the beast, if you will, that resides within before it comes out as it did with Sergeant Russell.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. Are you a veteran as well?
I am.
What brought you to this work?
I think it's because it's very important work. I'm not a clinician, but I was just drawn to it because we have a responsibility as citizens to support the men and women who volunteered to serve and protect us.
Well and we know you had a grant from the Department of Defense. There's 12 employees there, a pilot program affiliated with the University of North Carolina. What do you do?
We have 3 goals. One is to train at least 1,000 providers annually in North Carolina and to spread this, you know, throughout the nation. The second is to increase the number of TRICARE, that's the military health insurance, the number of providers who accept TRICARE. And the third is to create a database of providers who are interested in serving veterans. And we've made a lot of progress on that. This initiative is now into its well into its second year of implementation.
A couple of years ago when we were hearing reports that soldiers who claimed to have stress were brutally teased by their commanders. Now there's a clinic. Do you think that this signals that the military is changing, has changed its attitude towards mental health problems?
Well, it certainly has changed the attitude, but, you know, nevertheless, the stigma of seeing a mental health provider, you know, I'm told that in Iraq they call that the wizard, going to see the wizard, the stigma is unfortunately alive and well.
Well, and we hear troops talking about the John Wayne culture, and internally, they don't know what's wrong with them. They don't know why they're having feelings that they've told themselves they shouldn't have. But externally, traditionally, they've been told to buck up and not have those feelings. Are they encouraged to go see the wizard?
I would say they're encouraged to externally, but, you know, internally, they still don't want to let their buddies down. I was thinking when I learned of Keith's death that I processed it by myself, began to process it for a couple of hours, and that in the field, they may have 10 minutes.
Right.
And they've got to, you know, and they got to suck it up again, they got to stuff it, and that happens again, they got to stuff it, you got to stuff it, you got to stuff it. And it comes out in most inappropriate ways. So whether it's in rage, whether it's in isolation, whether it's in, you know, self-medication, those are the inappropriate ways, but that's what happens if you don't, shall we say, go see the wizard.
Well, and of course, the most painful of all, the rate of suicides and events like the death of 5 at this health clinic. Well, Time magazine is reporting for the first time in history a sizable and growing number of U.S. combat troops are taking daily doses of antidepressants to calm their nerves. A RAND study found that approximately 300,000 men and women who'd served in Iraq and Afghanistan were suffering from PTSD. That's nearly 1 in 5 returning veterans. One thing I'm thinking today is that I can't think of a time when Keith Springle was needed more.
No question about it. And let us not forget the million children, over a million children, under the age of 11, who had one parent deployed at least once.
Well, we know his friends and family will be holding a funeral for Commander Charles Keith Springle today. What do you want people to know we've lost?
We've lost a hero, but we've got to remember him as someone who would want us to persevere in this important and difficult work.
Well, and we will note that his family and friends have established the Charles Keith Springle PhD Memorial Scholarship Fund to support military-dependent students in the Masters of Social Work program at the University of North Carolina School of Social Work. So military families and more of them interested in mental health may be interested in knowing that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
That's Bob Goodale, Director of Behavioral Mental Health at the Citizen Soldier Support Program in North Carolina, friend and colleague of social worker and the late Commander Charles Keith Springle. For more on the scholarship created in his honor, go to our website, hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. That's Benga music. It originated in dance clubs in Kenya, but now a group of Kenyan musicians has teamed up with American rockers to bring the sound to the U.S. They call themselves Extra Golden. They're on tour promoting a new album, and Here Now's Jill Ryan caught up with them last month here in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The Kenyan ethnic language called Luo is not your typical American rock fare, but it's the language the Kenyan-American group Extra Golden chooses for many of its songs. And it doesn't seem to be an obstacle for American fans. They're more interested in the band's instrumentation.
They really do the multi-layered African guitar thing very well, where there's a lot of repeating parts that go over each other that make like a whole complicated thing, even though the parts themselves are relatively simple.
It's like you're painting with the same colors, but it's a completely different picture.
And in creating that picture, Extra Golden draws from many traditions. Heavy guitar riffs of American rock, bluesy piano chords that sound straight out of a New Orleans jazz club, and vocal melodies, often sung in chorus. Singer Onyango Jagwasi.
That is style of Benga, because in Benga, singers are like two or three, even four. So you sing like choir.
And though Benga rings through Kenyan dance clubs, the lyrics are not necessarily light or uplifting. Take the song Ukimwi by percussionist Onyango Wode Omari.
So I wrote that song to tell people that to be careful about AIDS. This kind of sickness is killing. So even those people who get married, you have to be careful about it.
Ukimwi is a reminder of the band's co-founder, Otieno Jagwasi. He died of AIDS complications in 2005, and it's his voice you hear on the band's first album, called Okoyote System. That album sprung from a chance encounter. In 2004, a curious American named Ian Eagleson traveled to Kenya to do research for his PhD in ethnomusicology. He was looking for local musicians who could teach him about Benga, and that's when he met Otieno.
The guy I asked just happened to take me to this club where he was, and I talked to him, and he was really nice. We became friends, and he started teaching me about their music. And after that, we practiced and worked on how to put our different songs together.
Those songs became Extra Golden's first album. And though Otieno didn't live to see it released, his brother Onyango Jagwasi did. He succeeded Otieno as lead singer. Onyango wrote the song Jackalondo as a tribute to Otieno after a nickname the brothers shared.
The song is just about how we miss him and we wish him good luck where he is now.
One thing band members remember about Otieno is that he was trusting and open to the ideas of others. And that's not something you see in Kenyan bands. Most have a strict hierarchy and domineering band leaders. Ian Eagleson says that's because instruments in Kenya are scarce.
Most working musicians don't have their own instruments, and the ones that do are usually the band leaders, who are maybe like the main star in a band and who write most of the songs that get recorded. And the problem is a lot of those guys fail to compensate the rest of the band in a decent way, you know.
And that can leave band members feeling powerless. Onyango Jagwasi says to vent frustration, they poke fun at band leaders by exchanging the Luo phrase okoyot, meaning it's not easy.
People are using that okoyot as a joke to enjoy the band leaders. They don't know what we are talking about.
The friction between musicians and band leaders often leads to high turnover in Kenyan groups. But most musicians don't have much of a choice except to keep on playing.
You have family to support, you have things to do. So even if they're doing for you bad, you don't have any other way. So you say, okay, let them just do it. I'll try to work hard. If maybe even one day, one time, I'll be stars and I'll start my own band and I'll be getting good money.
Jagwasi's ambitions are a far cry from the rock star fantasies of many American teenagers who may dream of selling out huge stadiums and having homes around the world. Jagwasi just wants to feed his family and to live without fear, like the fear that gripped him after the violence following the 2007 disputed presidential elections in Kenya.
There was violence everywhere. Musicians could not go to job. We do play in clubs, but all clubs were closed, so we had to stay in the house.
And that meant no income.
We have big families. We have so many people to take care of, and we did not know when we are going back to work again. So Ian and Alex put something in internet and asked for $5 donation. So we were able to move to good neighborhoods, and also we were able to help our families and provide them with daily needs. So the song Thank You Very Quickly, that song is just to say thanks for our fans, those people who help us. So thank you very quickly, that's all I can
say. You never know when you might be next. And even though touring with Extra Golden means Jagwasi spends less time with his family in Kenya, he says they're better off.
Being over here with Extra Golden, I'm seeing a lot of changes because I can get money, I can work, I can cut off all expenses. So it's helping me a lot. I'm happy with it and praying for us always, wishing us good luck always.